Thank you very much, John, and I'm delighted to have this opportunity to be here this morning. I first met Dr. Patrick in August of 1975. That was when I was driving down from North Dakota to Baton Rouge to start on my PhD with Dr. Patrick, and I'd stopped in Knoxville, Tennessee for the Soil Science Society of America annual meeting that was in August of 75, and that's where I met him the first time. And I think those of you who know Dr. Patrick will know of his and his wife's just kind generosity, because once I got to Baton Rouge, my first evening was spent at their house, where they looked after me very well and helped me get acclimated to the South. And it was just a delightful experience in working with him. What I'd like to do is share some of his early experiences with rice, and then go on to talk about rice and to show how rice and natural wetlands are very much related to each other. Now, it's interesting to note that for Dr. Patrick, he was actually working in rice already before I was in high school. And here's a paper from 1967 from the Experiment Station Bulletin, in which he was already writing about deep placement of nitrogen fertilizer in rice. So his early experience came out of rice, and his experience with rice and flooded soils were what then led to his work in the natural wetlands. About 10 years ago, he had the opportunity to come to Erie. And while he was at Erie, he gave a lecture, several presentations, but he's had a long history of interacting with Erie. Through his early involvement in rice, he was involved with Erie way back in the 1960s. Erie was formed in 1960, and already in the 1960s and into the 1970s, he was involved with scientists in rice production at the International Rice Research Institute. And when he was back at Erie about 10 years ago, he took the opportunity to say a little bit about his work, early work with Erie at Rice. So I'm going to see if this works now. Whoops.
Maybe even rebuttal, which I used to get a lot of those when I came here when Felix von Amperum was here. We ended up having pretty lively discussions and disagreements over the points.
So those of you who go back and know the history of Erie, Dr. Felix Ponnabaruma was the soil chemist at Erie. He was recruited in the 1960s. He retired in 1984, but a very well-known name in flooded soils and the chemistry of flooded soils. And indeed, my first experience of meeting Dr. Ponnabaruma and Dr. Patrick together was actually at, I think it was Fort Collins, at one of the Soil Science Society of America meetings. And indeed, I do remember there being a lively discussion between the two. So I think what Dr. Patrick is saying here was indeed got some truth to it. Now I'm going to go on and talk a little bit about rice and introduce you to rice, particularly those of you who have been working in the wetlands. Rice is produced on flooded soils, as you see here, in landscapes like this. 90% of the world's rice is produced in Asia, and it's produced in soils largely like are in these pictures, where the soil is flooded before the cultivation of the rice, during the transplanting of the rice, and during the growth of the rice crop. Now, this map here shows where rice is distributed across Asia and Africa, and you'll see the heavy concentration in China, across Southeast Asia, and India. The blue dots refer to the areas of irrigated rice, and the yellow dots for rain-fed lowland, and I'll explain more about these two systems. But they have a unique feature in that they both have bunded fields in which the water is impounded and the soils are flooded for much of the growing season. And indeed, this is the way the rice fields look in the Asian context, where there are bunds that are maintained around the fields. They hold the water on the field, and then from land preparation through to the establishment of the crop and the growth of the crop, the field is maintained in a flooded condition. And now, when Dr. Patrick was back at Erie, I think one of the things that really impressed me about him was his tremendous knowledge of rice production. Even though he had been working in the wetlands for 20, 30 years before this time, where he was already, or he had still maintained that tremendous knowledge of rice. This is what he had to say.
Rice is grown under flooded conditions. And it was a puzzle to Western scientists to come to Asia and in the early days and ask, why is rice flooded? Well, it's flooded because their fathers flooded and their father's fathers flooded. And so they had to speculate on reason why rice was flooded. And so the most obvious reason early on was to eliminate weed competition. And another obvious reason was the ease of seed bed preparation, because it's a lot easier to work with puddle soil than with wet soil than it is a dry, fodder soil for seed bed preparation. So those were obvious reasons. And of course, the superabundance of water was also a reason so that the plant always had an adequate supply of water.
Yeah, I thought it's interesting that he's really talking about agronomy and not about redox chemistry when he's faced with that question. So he really did have a background in agronomy and how to grow rice. Now, I mentioned that there are irrigated rice lands and rain-fed rice areas. The irrigated areas comprise about 50% of the land area for rice cultivation in Asia and account for about 75% of the rice production in Asia. And they are characterized by irrigation from different sources. The picture down here with the people in what appears to be Bangladesh or India is probably a type of picture that would have been common in the days when Dr. Patrick was traveling through those areas. Not so common today. Rain-fed lowland rice is comparable in the sense that it's surrounded by bunds, but the water comes from the rainfall only and not from irrigation plus rainfall. It is less productive, but it accounts for about 35% of the area and 20% of the rice production. And in these areas, there can be periods of drought during the season. So there are periods when the water may be in short supply, but there are also periods when there can be too much water and flash floods or submergence of the soil with more water than optimal for the rice crop. The wetland rice soils, or sometimes we refer to them as paddies or lowland rice, and lowland being the term meaning the type of cultivation practice, it doesn't necessarily mean an elevation. They're typically flooded, like you see here, and then plowed or tilled under flooded conditions. Then they're harrowed under flooded conditions to puddle the soil, which destroys the soil structure and creates a hard pan that holds the water in and also controls the weeds, as Dr. Patrick mentioned in that clip. This picture here of water buffalo and how they fitted into the process of land preparation was very typical in the past, not so common now. The cultivation practices then involve a crop establishment that is typically by transplanting, where germinated seeds are sown onto nursery beds like this, and the rice plants, after several weeks, are pulled from those nursery beds and then transplanted into the field, normally about 2 to 4 weeks after they have been growing in the nursery. The rice can also be established by a direct seeding, where germinated seeds are broadcast onto the soil. But notice, again, flooded soils or saturated soils that are well leveled. Machines can also be used for this. This is a drum seeder in which the germinated seeds are dropped in rows on soil that has saturated and leveled. So the first point I'd really like to make is for those of you who are working in natural wetlands, you can see that there's really a very close similarity in terms of the biogeochemistry between natural wetlands and rice paddies or lowland rice fields. They have similar characteristics in terms of the soil flooding and saturation. They have the similar properties in which the soil is, with the flooding, prevents or limits the diffusion of oxygen into the soil, and the anaerobic layers are very much influencing the biological and chemical processes that are taking place in the soil. I'm going to go on now to talk a little bit more about rice cultivation, and particularly how water is influencing rice cultivation. I'm going to start with the extreme in which there is ample water and the opportunity to grow rice continuously under tropical conditions. So when the water is not limiting, in the tropics, the climate is favorable to grow continuous rice. The process of harvesting, followed by the plowing and land preparation, and the transplanting can take place very quickly with just a few days of turnaround between these events. And you can see that the soil can remain saturated nearly continuously. We have a long-term experiment at Erie, referred to as the long-term continuous cropping experiment. This was started in 1963 when the scientists at that time, 3 years after the formation of Erie, had the foresight of seeing that rice could be grown intensively with modern varieties. And from 1968, three crops of rice have been grown continuously on this piece of land, so that there have now been 143 crops of lowland flooded rice cultivation on this piece of land. There's about 20 days between the crops, so the soil only dries out for about 1 week to 10 days between the crops. It's a very intensive cultivation system. There are multiple rates of nitrogen fertilizer and rice varieties that are changing. There are well-adapted varieties to the situation. To facilitate the processes of land cultivation, the above-ground residue is actually removed. So this is the way the field looks when the cultivation practice takes place. Now, one of the things is what happens to the carbon in these soils when they're continuously flooded. We published earlier some of the results for the carbon dynamics from 1983 to 1998. And these are some more data recently when we've looked at two additional years over now a 26-year period looking at the changes that are taking place in the total soil carbon in these systems. And these are systems in which the straw has been removed, but there is aquatic biomass. There are algae, particularly in the floodwater. Those algae, as they die and decompose, are adding some carbon. Roots are adding some carbon. So there is actually a steady state in terms of the carbon in these systems, where the carbon has not declined over 26 years. And this very much reminds me of another presentation that Dr. Patrick made when he, I believe on another trip to Erie, in which he showed this picture here and described decomposition.
The decomposition of organic material is very much greater than an oxidative condition than under anaerobic conditions. Just as an example, here's a snake that probably rolled the grass, drove in the salt marsh here in Louisiana. See the salt marsh on the other side? This is a tidal channel, which is a part-time off of the forest. It's a plant that's a lot of characteristics. But this was driven into this point right here and into the setup. So this below here was anaerobic. This zone was aerobic and saturated. And look at the decomposition that took place about 4 years since this state was driven in.
Yeah, this particular statement and comment by Dr. Patrick has been very influential in my career. Now, I have to have a disclaimer here. That's definitely not my hand and not me. Anyone who's worked at LSU knows that's Ron DeLong's hand, and it's Ron DeLong who is the person who is responsible for that stake. Now, another feature of flooded rice soils is the characteristic of the decomposition under flooded conditions that can lead to methane formation. These are data way back from 1993, probably by Reiner Vossman and others at Erie, who were measuring the emissions of methane during the entire growth period of a rice crop. And you can see that the blue here, where the straw is incorporated, leads to much more daily methane emission and cumulative methane emission than where the straw has been removed. So this is now a well-known phenomenon that methane is an important product of anaerobic decomposition within these rice soils and very much driven by the way the residue of the rice crop is managed. I'd like to now go on and talk a little bit about what happens when water becomes less abundant and the opportunity to grow continuous rice is no longer feasible. Under that condition, rather than growing two or three rice crops, it may be necessary to switch from rice to another crop. Could be a legume, could be corn, another crop. And already there are important cropping systems like this, like the rice wheat system in the Indo-Gangetic Plain of South Asia. Or it's possible in a triple cropping system to replace one of the rice crops with another crop. And a feature of this is now that the soil will be no longer flooded during a portion of the year and part of the cropping. There's a long-term experiment at Erie started in 1993 by Ken Kassman. And at those times, the scientists had the foresight, again, of seeing that rice cultivation could change from continuous rice to rotation of rice with other crops like corn. And here what we see is the rice system, where there's, or the rice maize system. So in the wet season, it's all rice. In the dry season, either rice or the maize. It's now in its 37th crop. And the difference is that with the rice, it's the conventional puddling process of land preparation, where the soil is flooded and tilled under flooded conditions to destroy the structure and create the hard pan. Under the maize conditions, the soil is dry and pulverized with a number of aerobic tillage activities that hasten the decomposition. And here is the result from the soil organic matter. And you can see, first of all, for the blue, the rice-rice system from 1993 to 2006, just as with the triple cropping system, there's no decline in the soil carbon. But where rice maize is practiced, where the rice is switched to maize, and there is the aeration and the oxidation that takes place in the tillage, there is a substantial or significant decline, about 12%, of the soil carbon, and then that carbon stabilizes. In that same experiment, we can use the yields of rice in plots that have received no nitrogen as a measure of the nitrogen supplying capacity. So we measure the yields in plots that are following rice and in plots that are following maize. And what we find is that the yield of rice after rice without nitrogen applied is significantly higher than the yield of rice that's following maize. So an indication that as part of this loss of soil organic matter, the nitrogen supplying capacity is also declined. So there is a decline in fertility. There is still the opportunity to put on more fertilizer to get the yields to near comparable levels or virtually comparable levels, but there is more input that's needed to achieve that when the system is rotated and the carbon is lost. And I found it rather interesting that still when way before I was in high school, or a bit before I was in high school, that Dr. Patrick was already publishing some of his early literature on some of these processes of alternate wetting and drying on nitrogen losses. And talking about, this was in incubation-type studies, but it's amazing how similar the numbers are to what really happened in the real world, in that indeed, in those cycles of alternate wetting and drying, there was loss of carbon and nitrogen under that alternate wetting and drying, and 15 to 20%, very similar to about the 12-15% that we found under field conditions. This is a figure from that same paper of 1964 in which there is that rather rapid loss of carbon and then a stabilization that reaches a new steady state. sort of humbling, isn't it, to realize that people were publishing on things when you were still not in high school? But really, some of these processes were well known, and we are following up on those processes, and we try to put them into the context of food production and maintaining and sustaining food production. Now I'd like to go on to the other type of system where there's alternate wetting and drying, where there are fallow periods between the rice crops. So just as there can be drying when the crop switches away from rice to corn or legumes, there are also periods between the rice crop when there may not be enough water for continuous cultivation of rice or growing any other crop, so the soil can dry out or the soil can go through various processes. There could be differences in water regime and tillage during these fallow periods that are between crops. And these fallows could often have some soil drying or some alternate wetting and drying, and then the soils, of course, are wetted up again during the rice cultivation. So alternate wetting and drying is very much a feature of rice cultivation, just as it may be in some natural wetlands. We have an experiment here in which we have three different water regimes and management practices in the fallow period between rice harvesting and the flooding of the soil for land preparation. In one case, we never let the soil dry. We just kept it flooded during the fallow. Another case, we went through a sort of a typical drying process. We actually put the field under use a rained out shelter to ensure that it dried out. And then we use soil drying with cultivation. Here's an example of the type of cultivation, and there was a tent over to the plots to prevent rainfall in the aerobic plots. And we had treatments, sub-treatments with and without straw. Now here is an example of some of the data, and like in the earlier slide I showed, we looked at the yield in the plots that did not receive nitrogen fertilizer as a measure of the nitrogen supplying capacity, of the measure of the soil to supply nitrogen to the crop. So this is the yield through time, through about 8 different years. These are dry seasons, so this is 8 years of data in which these are the yields of rice in which nitrogen is not applied. And notice that after several years where there was continuous flooding during the fallow, the fertility and nitrogen supplying capacity has gone up. And with the aerobic tillage just the soil drying, the nitrogen supplying capacity has gone down. This is due to many nitrogen processes that are simultaneously going on that are far more than what I can go through in this presentation. It's a combination of more nitrogen fixation with the continuous flooding. It's also differences in mineralization and immobilization. But the dynamics are indeed very important, and the process is most interesting. Again, here's a 1967 paper that brings us back to the reality check of now showing that the alternate wetting and drying not only had been influencing carbon and nitrogen, but also influencing plant growth. And what I find interesting here is the recognition that there were different types of soils. There were nitrogen-deficient soils, and there were nitrogen or fertile soils, particularly soils that had gone through some type of legume or pasture beforehand. So very much the results being influenced, the results of yield being influenced by the prior management. And indeed, so true in that the fallow management and the management of the land can very much influence the nitrogen supplying capacity and hence the growth of the next rice crop. Here is a figure that comes from some research I was involved in 1986 when I first went to Erie. And actually, this work, I must confess, was influenced by Dr. Padamparuma, because I had referred to him and referred to the lively debate between him and Dr. Patrick. Well, one of the features about Dr. Padamparuma was he was brilliant, but another feature of him in that brilliance, he wasn't always the best publisher. He had a lot of knowledge that was sort of hidden away, and one of the bits and pieces that was hidden away in the annual reports of Erie was the importance of really the growth of plants between rice crops on the dynamics of nitrogen and nitrate dynamics between rice crops. So we took that to the field and we did some measurements in different fields where we measured the nitrate in the profile after a rice crop. So the soil was drying up. Nitrate was accumulating during that dry period. So we measured nitrate in the soil and we measured the biomass of weeds and the amount of nitrogen taken up by the weeds. And it's probably not at all surprising that we found an inverse relationship where the more the weed growth was, the less nitrate was there. The weeds were taking up that nitrate, and what this shows is that the losses of nitrate upon reflooding for rice were then much less when there was more weed growth. So one of the leaky parts of a rice production system is the accumulation of nitrate during fallows or during an upland crop, and then the subsequent flooding that leads to that loss of nitrate by denitrification. Well, if that nitrogen or that nitrate can be accumulated in plants, and then those plants recycled as biomass, that nitrogen in the organic form then is sustained or maintained in the system. So this here was one of the works that goes back to the 1980s and an interesting part of understanding the fallows. Now I'd like to move on to some of the challenges that face us in the present and into the future. And there is going to be a substantial amount of rice production now and into the future that's going to be under conditions of heavy rainfall during the wet season or during periods of monsoons and floods. We're going to see flooding and heavy rainfall in some seasons, but we're also going to see dry seasons in which there's going to be limited amount of water for irrigation for rice. That water is going to end up being used for purposes other than agriculture. And we then need to come up with management practices to grow rice in these relatively high-yielding dry seasons with less water. And that would mean less duration of soil submergence, changes in the soil chemistry and microbiology. Now, I'm going to show a little bit of what some of the scientists in water research have been developing. One of the practices that they're working on is controlled irrigation, where rather than keeping the field continuously flooded, they are using an alternate wetting and drying, but a drying that does not have a negative effect on the rice yield. So rather than keeping a standing water, they're putting pipes like this, the perforated pipes, into the soil and monitoring the water level, and when the water level drops down into the soil to about 15 centimeters, irrigation takes place. So that's the soil is still saturated or sufficiently wet that there is no penalty on yield, and the wetting and drying cycle is rather short, so there's not much risk of losses of nitrogen. So this here is one of the ways to save water but to maintain yield. So this is referred to as alternate wetting and drying, or safe alternate wetting and drying, because you can safely do it without a penalty in yield. The other extreme is to actually grow rice under non-puddled conditions, to grow it like a wheat or a corn crop, in which the crop is established with dry seeding, and irrigation can be used, but the soil is maintained more at field capacity than under saturated conditions. And the soil is not flooded at any point during the entire growing season. This has been referred to as aerobic rice. So we take a contrast here to these different systems and try to show the importance of water and how it influences the processes of the soils. So the conventional right here is where there's puddle land preparation that I showed, transplanting or wet seeding as I showed, and the soil is remaining flooded or saturated during the growing season, and anaerobic conditions predominate. Now, the safe alternate wetting and drying is the same type of crop establishment and land preparation, but there is a drying process that takes place, but it should not get more dry than saturated conditions. So there's generally anaerobic conditions with only mild drying. The aerobic rice is not puddled. It's dry seeded. So that would be like some of the rice cultivation here in the United States. The field is drained, or there is at the time of the field of crop establishment, it's dry, and it's largely grown under aerobic conditions. There is no mid-season flooding and flooding for part of the growing season. This here will suffer a yield penalty. In the middle here is a dry seeded condition. Soil is not puddled, dry seeded, and the field is drained early on to establish the crop, so it's under dry conditions, but then can be saturated later. And while aerobic early, it remains essentially anaerobic later. The critical water content is about 10 kilopascals, so the water content is maintained wetter than about 10 kilopascals. And the intent is to see if this system can be established and developed to maintain high yields of rice and maintain the sufficient biology and chemistry of flooded soils to maintain that productivity. J.K. Latta, who's here, is one of the experts on this in his work in India. Here is the table that now starts showing you, as young scientists here, the opportunities that lie before us when we think about how to characterize these systems and understand their sustainability and productivity through time. We know a lot about the conventional puddled rice system in terms of these very critical factors. The yield, we know that it's a productive system. We know that the water use, however, is high. We want to use less water. We know methane is a risk. Nitrous oxide emissions are low because under the flooded conditions, there's not very much denitrification. The nitrous oxide is more a product of the alternate wetting and drying that can take place between rice crops. Nitrogen supply and BNF are relatively high. Phosphorus availability, relatively high under flooded conditions. Carbon storage, relatively high. Now, look at all the question marks and the boxes and arrows here, and we saying we don't really know about a lot of these other systems. The arrows going down suggest a decrease. Everything in red is sort of a guess. Real opportunities to understand these systems and in the context of sustainability and the context of global food security. We hope that with this safe alternate wetting and drying and dry seeding, we will have no yield penalty. We know with aerobic rice there's a yield penalty, so that's a disadvantage of that system. We expect to use less water in these systems, and we expect that methane emissions will progressively decrease as the water becomes less. But the risk of nitrous oxide becoming greater, the risks of losing some of that nitrogen supplying capacity are real. Possibly also some of the phosphorus availability will decrease. Possibilities that carbon will be lost. You can see there's a lot of opportunity here to better understand these systems. Now, the question then becomes, can you really grow rice under non-flooded conditions? Interesting, you know, people have been asking this question the last few years. This here was a question asked to Dr. Patrick about 10 years ago. So
do
here's the question.
That today, given our state of knowledge, that we can achieve the same kinds of yield in nutrient and situations so when they're irrigating their sort of wet soils that we achieve in flooded systems, or is that still a problem which we have no answer to?
Okay, so we can see what Dr. Patrick said.
With present varieties, I don't think it's possible. But there's no reason why selections can't be made that will develop varieties that don't need the reducing conditions that you get from submergence. But something will have to be done about develop finding lines that don't require maybe as much the higher iron requirement that rice has. And maybe other nutritional aspects of flooded soils that the physiologists can probably best describe. So it's a goal, and I think it can be reached, but it can't just be done now.
So one of the interesting things I find in listening to some of the past presentations of Dr. Patrick is his ready admission of the importance of plant breeders and plant physiologists to really recognize the many contributions that they have made and the contributions that they have in the future. Well, we're trying to take up this challenge, looking at rice farming systems and how they need to change. There's definitely a need to increase yields to maintain the amounts of food that are needed, And this is going to have to be done with less land, as land is being lost for urbanization and other activities, less water for irrigation, and less labor to do the operations. So more mechanization will also be needed. And, of course, doing it in the context that it must be environmentally friendly and ability to be resilient and adapt to changing climates. We're in the process of initiating research on intensive rice production systems. Some of that is being done at Erie. Some of that's being done in South Asia under the leadership of Dr. Lada, who's here. And these are systems in which we are looking to intensification with growing three crops per year, so intensification, but diversification, not just continuous rice, but there could be other crops in rotation with rice, with very much a focus on saving resources, efficiency of water use, and high yields with efficient management of those inputs, and, of course, the protection of the environment and adaption, ability to adapt to the changing climate. So here's an example of the research that has been initiated in the last year at Erie, where there's a production plot. This is a 4-hectare area. So a 4-hectare production plot is put in, two of them have been established, where one cropping system is established over that entire area. In the middle is the eddy flux measurements that are looking at evapotranspiration and heat and carbon balances. In addition to that, there are adjacent to this replicated experiments with the same management that is under the production area and just difference in water management. There are also varietal screening trials, just as Dr. Patrick had mentioned of the importance of selecting varieties. These varietal trials go hand in hand at these same locations. And the question we're trying to answer is, how do we make dry-seeded rice work? How do we make a system that takes less water and goes away from the water intensity of puddling to an alternative? How do we make that sustainable? How do we make it work? Instead of puddling, we're using dry seeding like this. In this particular case, on these production plots, we're using center pivot irrigation to put on a uniform amount of water and to save water. And here are the results from the first season. And this is the production area under that irrigation was about 3.2 hectares. The average yield with that dry-seeded rice was about 5.3 tons per hectare. Not so high, but better than what had been achieved in the past under these systems at Erie. But notice the big surprise. The range in production across that 3.2 hectares was from 4 to 7 tons. That was shocking. These are fields that have gotten identical water management, optimal water management. These are fields that have gotten optimal fertilizer management. A large part of that variation was probably due to drainage. So there's a lot of micro variation in terms of water regime and soil properties. These are fields that are coming out of cultivation of puddled rice. So this is a real-world situation where there are very diverse fields coming out of puddled rice cultivation in which we were trying to transform them into a futuristic type of rice production system and meeting tremendous spatial variability, and that spatial variability affecting the yields and what we can do. In addition to that, there are pest problems that now become prevalent, like root knot nematodes that are not a problem under flooded conditions but become a problem under dry conditions and more serious as the soil gets drier. So this here presents one of the real challenges and opportunities for scientists in the future. And I'd like to close then by summarizing and saying what I think are some of the challenges before us. The biogeochemical processes are really comparable for rice soils and for the natural wetlands. I think it's easy when you see this to see how a person like Dr. Patrick could go from rice to natural wetlands and back and forth with a great deal of ease. The productivity of these wetland soils has been sustained with ample water resources. But we do need to sustain that productivity in the future with less irrigation water. And what that means is that research is going to be incredibly important. Some of the same research that you, those of you here are engaged in wetland soils is just as important in the soils for rice cultivation. These are looking at rice management in terms of the carbon storage, the nutrient cycling, the greenhouse gas emissions, nutrient supply and capacity, balances, energy balances, water, and to really try and understand what's the critical duration and management of water and how much submergence do we need in these systems to maintain their productivity and sustainability, control the weeds and all these other factors. Tremendous research opportunities. For myself, I think I'm one of Dr. Patrick's first students in marine sciences, but then I went on to work in agriculture. Some have done it the other way. Dr. Chua here, who has worked in rice with me, and worked in the wetlands back and forth. So I think a parting message is it's really possible to move back and forth, as Dr. Patrick showed. And there are many opportunities and challenges out there for bright young minds in global food production. Thank you very much.
Retrospective, this being the 75th anniversary of the soil science meeting, I think it took us even back maybe even earlier than that. Are there any questions for Dr. Perez?
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question. I'm a little unclear. The dry seeded, is that similar to how the production practices in the Mid-South, where there's it's seeded dry and a flood is put on, or are you talking about more of an irrigation scheduling throughout the season where you don't actually fully flood it and keep it anaerobic throughout the season? I was a little unclear on which way that was or if you were working on both.
Okay, so the question is about the dry seeding practices that I was referring to. It's a dry seeding like it would be in the south with no flood water, but it does not involve the mid-season flood and then keeping the field flooded for part of the year. It involves keeping the field without standing flood water. So the aerobic rice is where the soil would be maintained more like at field capacity, whereas what I was referring to dry seeding, there would be no standing water, but the soil would be nearer to saturation. So the question relates to the opportunities of no-till in these non-rice crops and the ability to save carbon. Yes, that's the next step, and there's active research on that in terms of reduced tillage and no-till systems. And indeed, machinery is an important component of that. With the work that we've done in the Philippines, we've been able to show that we can establish a maize crop into the rice stubble with no yield penalty on the maize. So the key is really about the water management. And this would be with irrigated maize, so we do need to wait until the soil is dry enough that we can establish the maize crop and then irrigate the maize. But we can grow it with no-till, with no yield penalty as compared to the conventional full tillage. There are some implications in terms of residue management and weed management, but the main implication is really the need for the appropriate machinery. And the appropriateness of that machinery can be very much dependent upon the soil texture and moisture conditions. So it's something that does take some work. There's also considerable work being done on this in South Asia, in the context of the Indo-Gangetic Plain and the rice wheat and rice maize systems. There the soils tend to be a bit lighter in texture than what we're doing working with at Erie. But yeah, we're hoping that those are systems then that can conserve that carbon and prevent that loss of carbon as well. And these are things that we'll be studying in this 4-hectare production plot and with the eddy covariance flux towers to look at carbon and energy balances. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that the rice has been fertilized with nitrogen. And I was wondering, during the intercropping when you chose maize, what is the reason why no leguminous crop was chosen? Because mm-hmm. that would be a natural way of, you know, practicing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the question is, why not grow a legume crop in rotation? Yeah, certainly there is the opportunity to grow legumes as well as a cereal crop. In rain-fed environments, legumes can be quite common. So in a rain-fed rice environment where there is only enough water for one rice crop, the opportunities can present themselves to grow a short-duration legume crop after that rice, more on the residual moisture, and that's an area of considerable research and opportunity. In this particular examples that I'm showing, we've been looking at really trying to grow crops that can have high economic value. So the profitability of growing the maize would have been greater with some of the legumes. The legumes can contribute some fertility, but you can also get high yields with the maize if you put on apply enough fertilizer to the maize. In the future, we will probably be in the Philippine context, Southeast Asia context, particularly looking at crops like mung bean, because if we can get the yields up high enough, they can become quite economically attractive. So, and in the work that we're doing, when we start looking at production areas, we're very conscious of the profitability as well as the soil fertility. So we're really looking at this in the context of an ecological intensification perspective, where we're trying to optimize the profitability and the productivity and the environmental consequences as well as the nutrient cycling and nutrient efficiencies. In the back. Yeah, the question is, are we doing any research on silicon? I am not directly involved in that. The silicon issues really depend a lot upon the soils and the age of the soils or the types of the soils. So in the Asian context, the interest in silicon has been particularly been on some of the older soils, like in Japan. Some little measurements that we've done is we know the silicon contents are quite low in some of the highly weathered soils of the degraded soils in the Red River Delta of North Vietnam. But generally on the alluvial soils where most of the rice is grown, the silicon content is relatively high. So while there's been interest in it in certain locations, I've not been very involved in it. And it does come down to some real economic issues in terms of how to get the material on versus just recycling the biomass and recycling the residue, which probably would be one of the most productive ways. It's interesting that in soils like in the degraded, the older soils of the Red River Delta in North Vietnam, one of the ways those soils have really maintained sustainability is through the inputs of carbon and organic materials. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, good question. The question is, are there problems with pest and disease with continuous rice? Yeah, as a soil scientist, I have to admit that the greatest problem in continuous rice is not soil science. It's really disease. It's viruses that are transmitted by insects. So if we look across Asia and look at the main constraints of continuous rice cultivation, like in South Vietnam, parts of Indonesia, the problem that usually comes up because of the lack of synchrony in the planting, the fact that there's always rice in the field means that the insect pest has always got some habitat. The insect pest in these cases is not the culprit. It's the viral disease that the insect is transmitting. So in the Philippines, we have a disease referred to as tungro that's transmitted by the green leafhopper. And where there's triple cultivation, three crops of rice, that lack of synchronized planting leads to habitat where the green leafhopper is always present, and that then leads to the tungro. There's some varietal selection that's possible, but it still can be a problem. And the interesting thing is that when you look at the fallow management and you look at what I presented about the benefits of flooded soils in the fallow, that even with those benefits on the soil fertility is probably not a practice I would recommend to farmers. Because when that field stays flooded, it creates a habitat in which it can, some of these insects and pests can be maintained. So we have some real interesting things before us as scientists. This is almost heresy, isn't it, to say that the management practice that leads to the highest buildup of carbon and the greatest stabilization of carbon may not necessarily ecologically be the most sustainable practice because it's bringing about greater susceptibility to some pests and diseases, whereas if we go in and do aerobic tillage, we can better control some of those pests and diseases. So then questions like legumes and cover crops and how we manage the biomass on those fields become very important. So the point here is there's still a lot of research to be done in understanding and optimizing these systems. Yeah, great.
Roland, much of the research has shown that as inundation period decreases, weed problems increase. Mm-hmm. Given that most of the rice is produced by resourceful poor farmers, how do you see us approaching that problem?
Okay, so the question deals with how do we manage weeds in the future in these systems. I think herbicides are going to be an important component of this. When we look at the dry seeding systems, we're seeing that herbicides are an essential part of that management. And we see that water management is a critical part of ensuring the effectiveness of those herbicides. So we are looking at them in the context of as a package where we can optimize the moisture content to get good control with the herbicides, doing a rotation of herbicides. Manual hand weeding, possible, but again, labor will become a constraint. So we need to do that in the context of what's available with labor. But no doubt, weeds will become a major issue to manage in these systems as water becomes limited. The biggest constraints we're facing right now in making these systems work, weeds, machinery, varieties, the nutrients we're getting fairly well understood. Weeds become a big part of that constraint.
If I could hold everyone another minute here. One of the things that we have for the speaker, and this is normally a task that Mrs. Patrick has actually come to the meeting to do, and she was unable to travel to this meeting. And the nice thing was that Roland was able to come to LSU Baton Rouge before the conference, and we had actually lunch with Mrs. Patrick at her house. And I thought it was highly appropriate that she served us crawfish etouffee, because in Louisiana, with the flooded rice fields, they also raise crawfish in those very same fields. So probably having a dry rotation is probably not going to happen in Louisiana. But here is a commemoration for your
and a
special thanks from the Society for coming and giving such a great talk. And please join me in again thanking Dr.